quite recently a summit of international scientists from various scientific fields convened to discuss the impact of the materialist ideology on science and the emergence of a post-materialist paradigm for science, spirituality, and society. Included in their manifesto states, "The post-materialistic paradigm has far-reaching implications. It fundamentally alters the vision we have of ourselves, giving us back our dignity and power as humans." Dr. Mario Beauregard, neuroscientist, professor, and author, co-authored the manifesto developed and is here today. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Being a lead author of the manifesto for a post-materialistic science, you are known as a maverick along with your other co-writers. Can you give a brief description as to why you and the fellow authors wrote this?
Well, it's related to the history of modern science, actually. So, about 400 years ago, with the birth of modern science, physicists proposed a number of postulates, so that is, hypotheses about the nature of the universe and reality. And one of these postulates was materialism. So it's the idea that everything in the universe is based or is based on matter. In other words, material particles and fields also. Another idea is what we call reductionism. So it's the idea that you can reduce all sorts of complex phenomena and systems in the universe to elementary processes based on material phenomena or physical phenomena. And so at the beginning, these were only postulates or hypotheses, like I said, but after a few centuries, scientists forgot about that and they started to believe in these postulates. And these postulates became, after a while, during the 19th century, they became like dogmas. And these dogmas altogether created what has been called scientific materialism. So it became scientific materialism became the modern scientific worldview, if you will. And it became very dominant in science during the 19th and also during a good deal of the 20th century. And why did we write the manifesto? Because we think that now there's enough evidence, empirical evidence, regarding mostly consciousness, but also physics. Because in physics, they've had their own revolution about 100 years ago. So the physicists were not able to understand within the framework of the old physics, the classical physics. They were not able to understand a number of phenomena at the atomic level. And so they had to devise a new physics that was called quantum mechanics. And this happened, it took about a few centuries because before it was totally accepted within the community of physicists. And now we are in the same situation than physics a century ago. But this time it's all about consciousness. So there are all sorts of phenomena related to consciousness, like, for instance, near-death experiences during cardiac arrest. This is a very important phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon that cannot be interpreted or explained within a classical materialist framework. Because the reason is that when there is a cardiac arrest, the blood flow to the brain will cease very rapidly after a few seconds. And if you're measuring the electrical activity of the brain in that state, you will see that the line depicting the electrical activity will become totally flat after usually 10 to 20 seconds. So in principle, in that kind of state, there's no mental functions that are possible. Mental functions like perception, for instance, or self-awareness, consciousness, and so on and so forth. And yet, during the last 14 years, there have been, I think, five different studies conducted in Europe, in the UK, in the Netherlands also, and also in the United States. And these studies have documented, reported the case of over 100 patients who were clinically dead following a cardiac arrest, and yet they were able to perceive, they were able to have feelings, they were conscious, and so on and so forth. And in some cases, they were able to report veridical information about what took place while they were clinically dead. And so that's how we know that what they were reporting is accurate.
Yes.
So that's one phenomenon which is very important, which invalidates the old materialist view. But there are other phenomena, like, for instance, the so-called psychic phenomena, like telepathy, for instance, or clairvoyance, remote viewing, and so on and so forth. And it's very difficult to understand or explain these phenomena within a strict materialist framework. You cannot explain these things. And another major problem with the old view is that you simply cannot understand consciousness. You cannot understand how, because there's a huge gap between what we measure with our tools. For instance, when you use scanners, or we measure for the electrical activity of the brain using electrodes, for instance, what we're measuring is totally different than what we are experiencing at the in the first person, subjectively, experientially. So in other words, the propagation of a nerve impulse along a neuron in the brain, it's a phenomenon that is totally different than a thought or an emotion. A thought doesn't have a volume or a mass, or doesn't have any weight. Yet it is very powerful because it can transform the brain. It can change not only what's going on in terms of brain activity in various regions, but we know now that it can also lead to even structural alterations in the brain in terms of gray matter and white matter and so on and so forth. You see, there are tons of evidence pointing in this direction and indicating that it's now time to abandon the old materialist framework.
When you were just talking about how the body or the brain can be changed by a thought or emotion, mm-hmm. is there some kind of equipment or testing that can be done to actually tell a difference between a thought or an emotion?
The tools that we're using are not that sensitive yet.
Okay.
But what you can do for sure is that you can show that, for instance, if you can change your thoughts or your beliefs and emotions within a psychotherapeutic context, for instance, if you measure, you scan the people before the psychotherapy and after, you will see dramatic changes in their brains. And we've done that in my lab a number of times, but it's been done also in other labs and all over the world. So that's one aspect. If we take the case of belief, for instance, there's an interesting phenomenon, the placebo effect. So the placebo effect is based only on the beliefs and expectations that a patient has with regard to a treatment that is not at all effective from a medical point of view. So placebo can be, for instance, saline water or sugar pill and so on and so forth. And there's a very interesting brain imaging study that was done over 10 years ago here in Vancouver, Canada. It was done with Parkinsonian patients. And in Parkinson's disease, there's a progressive destruction of neurons in the brain that are producing a chemical messenger that is called dopamine. And dopamine is involved in all sorts of functions, but it's also the key chemical messenger in motor activity. And in the case of the people who participated in this study, their level of destruction of the nerve cells was ranging about between 70 to 80%. So they were advanced, and so they had a lot of symptoms. They were very severely impaired. They had trouble moving. They were shaking, and so on and so forth. And so a group of neurologists told them that they might have discovered a new revolutionary treatment for Parkinson's disease. And as a matter of fact, it was only saline water that they injected to them. And remarkably, the patient started to produce in their brains amount of dopamine comparable to what you see in young, healthy people. So this is very remarkable. And this is only one example of the power of mind over matter and over what's going on in the brain.
Absolutely, yes. And you also, in reading about other pieces of your work, I saw the research about serotonin in higher consciousness, at what's considered higher consciousness. And I'm wondering, share a little bit about that, the levels of serotonin and one's ability perhaps to remain more conscious of a higher consciousness and how all of that works. Are there people studying how to actually produce more of the serotonin, and perhaps obviously with the dopamine as well that could happen?
Yeah, it could be done probably using an approach that we call neurofeedback. So in my lab, we did a few brain imaging studies about the first brain imaging studies about the impact of neurofeedback. Neurofeedback is it's the technique that allows you to learn to control your electrical activity, your brain waves. And so when you do that, you transform your brain. So we did brain imaging studies of people who underwent this kind of training. And so we scanned them before and after training, after a few months of training. And we showed that not only were they changing the way some brain regions were functioning, brain regions that were involved in that case, it was mostly related to attention, but they were also changing or increasing the amount of gray matter, that is the number of neurons, and also white matter, the connections between neurons in these regions. And all this was happening in very short amount of time, in few months. So the basic principle of neurofeedback is that if you provide people with feedback that can be visual feedback or can be through sounds, for instance, and this can be related to all sorts of physiological functions in your body, not only to brain activity. In principle, we should be able to control the function. So you were talking of serotonin or dopamine. So if we could devise a technology that allows us to receive a feedback about our levels of production and release of serotonin or dopamine in our bodies, I assume that we would be able to learn how to modulate the production and release of these chemical messengers. You only need to have the right sensors, the right technology to allow you to do this. But it should be possible, yes.
Yes, and you just mentioned the word attention.
Yes.
I can see how that would, you know, being able to facilitate and create a greater attention span could just have such a voluminous effect, it seems.
Yeah, attention is it's one of the core aspects of consciousness. It's a key. You have to learn how to master this thing, and this is why it's so important in various meditative practice all over the world, and in spiritual traditions, in particular in Buddhism. And so the Buddhists train their brain. So I've investigated the nuns, Carmelite nuns.
Yes.
Cloistered nuns, but also I've worked with some monks and Buddhist monks, and we've done all sorts of experiments. And So these people, these monks, train their attention for not only hundreds but thousands of hours. And when they do that, of course, they change the functional activity in the regions involved in various attentional processes. They also change at the same time the structures of these brain regions. And now we have a number of studies showing that even if you're practicing these techniques for only a few months, you are already changing your brain, the activity of the regions, but also the structure of these regions. This is what we call neuroplasticity. So there's a lot of plasticity in our brains. For nearly a century, neuroscientists thought that the brain was a static machine, totally fixed, and it was not possible to change it through our lives. But during the last 3-4 decades, we have realized that it's totally the reverse. As a matter of fact, it's a very flexible machine, organ, and it can be changed drastically.
The potential that's being shown to us is just phenomenal. And
yeah, because the mainstream view, well, it's still very much influenced by hypothesis or the dogmas I was telling you about earlier,
yes,
by materialism and reductionism. So still a number of scientists in my field, and also in other disciplines, they consider human beings as complex biophysical machines. They're convinced of that. Still, despite all the converging lines of evidence showing that this is not the case at all. In the end, it's a battle of ideology. It's a kind of culture clash between belief systems.
Yes, years ago, talking with Dr. Bruce Lipton, for instance, when he was doing his research at Stanford, he said, "Yeah, I'd be doing my research," and he was finding out all of this stuff about the cells and how important environment was and everything. And so he'd go to the lunchroom and talk to all these scientists, and everyone would go, "Yeah, really? Is that true?" And then he said they'd go back to their cubicles, back to the old mindset. And it's hard for me to believe that scientists are still stuck in that.
Yeah, but the reason is that scientific materialism became the equivalent of a religion, but it became the dominant view within science. And if you dare challenge this, there's a price to pay. So in reality, there's only a minority of scientists who are extreme materialists or physicalists. It's a minority. When you talk with them in private, you realize that. But they are protecting themselves because they don't want to lose their their reputation, their funding, and so on and so forth, because the scientific building is still, the scientific institution, it's still built on, it's still related deeply to this old old worldview.
Yes, yes.
So it will take a few decades, I think, before we see the changes. But it's already changing. Because there, you have an increasing number of scientists who dare challenge this view openly in various fields now. But it's still a minority, but there's a movement going on. And you take the case of our manifesto, for instance. It's been signed by several scientists all over the world in various disciplines. And some of these scientists are very well-known, famous, but they are now old. They are not working anymore at the university, so they are not afraid
right.
of doing something like that. They don't have anything to lose anymore, so it's more tricky for younger scientists.
Yes, and things certainly are changing more quickly just because that's the way information is traveling around the world these days.
Yes.
Your book, Absolutely. Brain Wars, came out in 2012, and I'm wondering if you can speak to what's shifted since you wrote that book?
I can tell you that all the ideas presented in this book So the idea, for instance, that mental activity can change the brain, not only functionally, but also in terms of structure, or that there's also a non-local mind. So it's the idea that the mind is not confined to the brain and the body, because it can exert effects outside the confines of the brain and the body. These ideas and all the empirical evidence that is presented to support this emerging view, most people all over the planet, they don't have any problem with this. It fits with their conception of the world. In the scientific world, there's a progression. There's an evolution that is going on. More and more scientists are willing to accept, to listen to the evidence and to discuss. So it's only a minority that still believe very much in the old materialist worldview. However, this minority is very influential.
So, that 1%, you know, here we are again.
People like Richard Dawkins, for instance, in the UK, or Daniel Dennett. But if you look at them, in reality, they're about, 15, 20 people, very vocal all over the planet, who are leading this movement, but it's going downhill. So now you're seeing books with titles like The Waning of Materialism and The End of Materialism, and we can see that there will be a transition toward a new paradigm. This paradigm, I've called it post-materialist.
I know that you've been with the Dalai Lama, and I'm wondering, did you gain insights from him? They've been studying the brain's role in spiritual experience. Wouldn't sitting in silence reveal spirit's role in brain experience?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the point of view. Yeah, when I went to Melbourne to attend this forum with the Dalai Lama, I was there were two other neuroscientists there. But these scientists represented the mainstream view, the materialist and reductive view of the mind and the spirit. But the Dalai Lama was in agreement with me, so we were on the same page. And he has participated, he has created research projects with his monks in the United States at University of Wisconsin and so on and so forth, and in other labs. And the problem is that the scientists who led these experiments, they interpret the data in a very reductive and materialist way.
In reading about your biography, you grew up in the country as a child, and you've always had this openness.
As a matter of fact, I started to have spiritual experiences when I was a child. That was the starting point, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing today.
The thing that always blows my mind is about proof. They say they have proof, and they go through whatever.
But they are making they are confusing correlation with causality. So that's a major problem, because what we do in neuroscience is that we are collecting correlations. So you're measuring, for instance, with a scanner, what's going on in the brain during all sorts of mental tasks. It can be an emotion, it can be thoughts or beliefs, or even a spiritual state. You're recording changes in terms of brain activity. And at the same time, the subjects of the experiment is experiencing changes subjectively, deep within. And you're trying to establish a link between those two types of changes. But these are what we call correlation. So it means that whenever there's one phenomenon that is changing, the other one is also changing at the other level. But that doesn't involve any type of causality. So it's not because you are reporting, for instance, that you are experiencing something spiritual internally, that this something, this experience, can be reduced strictly and systematically to the electrical or the chemical changes that are measured in the brain of that person at the same time. So our limit in neuroscience is correlation. So it's not because there's a correlation that there's causality involved. And I always take the TV analogy to explain this. For instance, a TV receptor will encode and convert electromagnetic fields that are emitted from the TV station. And if you alter the electronic components within your TV set, you will see a distortion in terms of the images or the sounds. And But that doesn't mean that the person is within your TV set if you lose the person.
Right.
The person disappears from your sight. And it's the same thing for the relationship between mind and brain. Of course, if you have a lesion in specific portions of your brain, you might impair, for instance, memory or attention and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean that the source of the mental activity and the spirit is produced by the brain. This is a huge distinction. So these are not really proofs. They are simply relationships. So don't worry, people. They're not about to demonstrate that we are real biophysical machines, because they cannot. That's not what science is really showing. This is only ideology, dogma. And they do that because they have an agenda. So it's a game. They are trying to win. It's a culture war.
Is there anything, Mario, that you would like to say in closing about what you're involved in right now specifically?
Well, yes, I'm trying to create a sort of association or between all the scientists of the world who share a post-materialist view of the world in various disciplines. So this is very important, because the more we do that, the more we'll be able to transform effectively science from within. And so I'm also involved in the development of new models about mind-brain relationship and consciousness also.
Yeah.
And at the University of Arizona, we're starting a research project about what we call universal love. Mm. So this is the first experimental project about this form of love. This is very timely, I think. Very important for the future of our species.
Absolutely.
Because we need that badly.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can check in a year and see how it's going and what's going on.
Yeah, at this point, we are creating the first scientific scale to measure this form of love. And once we have the scale, and it should be in a few months from now, once the scale is validated scientifically, then we'll be able to use it to measure this capacity in humans across the world. And we'll also be able to use that to establish correlations between what's going on internally in the body with respect to this capacity, to this form of love. For instance, what is the impact of this form of love on genes or the immune system, the endocrine system, the brain, and so on and so forth. And we also have plans to measure the non-local impact, the impact that this form of love can have outside the confines of the brain and the body, with regard to other human beings, but also to it could be plants or microorganisms and so on and so forth. So.
Coming from where you did into science, I know that you already know the answers to this, so I really commend you for slogging it through with scientific proof here.
I do that because science is one of the most influential institutions in the world. It has replaced traditional religions. If you want to have an impact, for me, it's important to remain within this system, to try to change it from within.
Yes, from within. Dr. Mario Beauregard. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.